This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Bill Russell and I, Paula, have the delight to be with Professor Dr. Simon Sharma, who also does television and radio and movies. And
I sing.
You dance.
Early in the shower.
Before moving to some of these other remarkable things that you do and think about, A, I want to make sure we do talk about freedom, because that continues to be the great light of the world looking to the best that is America. And and this is an important idea. And the other thing that I thought that you introduced beautifully was it, you absolutely defy the notion that somehow the African who has come to America and becomes the slave, that somehow they are passive. That time and time and time again, as you talk about the first women to vote as being liberated black slaves in Sierra Leone, having been liberated from the United States, by that time United States. You talk about all of these firsts for democratic ideas. This real affirmation of the experience of a whole people who have been enslaved, not simply rolling over.
No, it's fantastically moving, actually. I mean, wherever you look, the different sort of evidence. The evidence sometimes comes at you through a back door. For instance, our picture of families led by women very often at great risk to themselves. You're caught, you could be flogged till you were dead, practically, or you could be actually be hanged, or you could be sent to saltpeter mines. I mean, awful things. So it's just enormous risk taken in this great flight. And no matter how scoundrelly or incompetent or hopeless the British are, and there are all those three things, this flight to the British happens from the beginning, from 75, all the way through to the awful debacle at Yorktown, and even beyond that. But I'm saying that there is actually, in New York at the end, in response to Carlton's refusal to return the blacks to the South, an Anglo-American commission is set up at the docks. It's a table, and there are two American officers, two British officers, and they examine all those who claim to come fall within the British proclamations, and therefore to leave New York and leave America, continuing their vote with their feet against America. They examine them in terms of where they've come from and when they fled. So we have this extraordinary document called the Book of Negroes, which has 3,000 tiny potted histories. And there you can just piece together. What it asks them is how old they were, which masters they left, where the plantations were. You can put together a kind of human geography. It's like backwinding a very old piece of archive film. And lo and behold, you know, out of scratchy silly load, this extraordinary phenomenon appears. It's sort of like Birth of a Nation in reverse, if we're going to do the movie. And it was the birth of their nation. And what I was going to say in response to your wonderful softball point, Paul, wonderful point, is it's absolutely true. What's remarkable, because being Jewish, I think about this as well, is that very often in flight, it was always said, you know, if you're part of my family, were Lithuanian Jews, that that the violin was always the instrument of choice because you couldn't run with it, really, in the way which you couldn't with the piano. Probably not relevant, but it was the same way you see actually en route, wherever they were going, following the army, dealing with the many sick who were dying of smallpox. The black churches are incredibly important. To have a free black church in a city like Charleston or New York was incredibly important. It meant your children, again, were legally baptized. It meant you had a legal marriage. The first black schools open in Nova Scotia, where they go to, incredibly tough-minded black school mistress called Catherine Abernathy. It was probably the first free black schoolmistress, school teacher that we know about. And the semblance of the first black politics in response to, in Nova Scotia, a strong and entirely justified sense of anger that the promises of the king were not being kept, except in a nominally legal way. What this community got was the sort of respect for their technical freedom, but no land. And the land was what they needed to establish themselves with this, one has to call it, Jeffersonian ideal of being a free small farmer.
Well, and also, you do say specifically it's always about the land.
It is. And it was part of the promise.
Absolutely. It was a lot of land. I mean, a promise between, depending on how many children you had, could be up to 200 acres, you know. It was a lot of land. It was never as much as the white loyalists were promised. And the thing about Nova Scotia was chosen, people always ask me, because it was, you know, underpopulated, the British having done their own little bit of ethnic cleansing with the Acadians. So it was thought of as prosperous. There were fish, there was naval timber. It was thought to be, once you cleared the trees, so fertile, you could sort of bang your foot in it and up the cabbage would pop, you know. Not the case. And it was thought to be running with small fairy animals, you know. There was a strange beaver shortage. No one could quite make out which is the one animal you really wanted, because you wanted to make top hats and felt, yes. So, in fact, it was in response to a sense of bitter betrayal. It was the white loyalists who were not, they were going with their own slaves. So they were not best pleased to have a substantial free black population coming with them and spreading uppity ideas among their own household servants and slaves. What? Secondly, they didn't much fancy the idea of doing too much labouring themselves, even though some of them came from very simple, ordinary backgrounds in America. They weren't all fat, pipe-swilling, port-swilling Tories. But they, you know, if they were going to get a cheap labour source, they would take it. So they had an interest, again, in not giving them back, obstructing the delivery of land, so that the blacks would be forced to be indentured servants.
Well, and it's
and work on the roads, and that's what happened.
Yeah, and I think it's that you know, the colonial perspective, because that is not, you know, the process by which the people were manipulated.
Right.
You know, if they have no way of feeding themselves, then they right. then they become they were will work for whatever they will be paid.
That's right.
Just to get keep body and soul together. Right. We'll sell off. And a lot of these people came with some goods.
Right. They'd have to sell off exactly what they
needed. And they become essentially indentured servants.
That's right.
And in fact,
indentured servants.
Right.
Some of it then doubles back and they become enslaved.
Well, and wage slaves.
Well, they become wage slaves. So they actually see wage slavery as an oxymoron. They're quite right. In other words, they take the evidence of any kind of wage to court. And as you know, there are cases where they win, not always, but strikingly often, actually.
Because?
The magistracy. Well, I think actually the magistracy, we know about two high court judges in Halifax itself who were, there was a strong, they weren't Quakers, but it was a very strong Quaker presence in Halifax. And while not all Quakers were abolitionists, a very large number, as we know from, you know, Benjamin Rush and Franklin and Benazir, there was a very strong abolitionist element inside the Quaker Church. And
some Quakers owned slaves.
There were some who traded slaves as well, as absolutely right. But in Halifax, there was definitely an early abolitionist sentiment among the among some of the judges, and indeed some of the churchmen. So there is at least a background. Remarkably, when the escaped slaves, when the blacks went to court to make sure that they weren't being depressed to the status of slavery, there was someone to listen to them. And all through this story, it's rather touching. I mean, we talked about that commission behind their table on the deck at New York and just at the dock. And what was striking to me was that the vast majority of these testimonials were just oral. There had been very little. Some of them who served in the army, the Black Pioneers, for example, would have had little pieces of paper signed by the officers who swore them, especially if they themselves had become NCOs, sergeants and corporals, which many of them were. But if you were just Suki with Lucy and Joe, you know, age 5 and 2, you just had your story to tell. But they were believed by both the Americans and the British, it has to be said. So this is kind of another first, that actually a slave tells you the story and you believe them. And the same thing was true when they fought some of those cases in Nova Scotia. So you can feel that in desperation and anger and tenacity and great material distress, the sort of sinews of what will become characteristic of the African-American community coming together. And there was this, you know, famously is one, I mean, the person I identify, and I can't see who else it would be, as the first identifiable African-American politician, as a sergeant in the British Army called Thomas Peters, who is called, becomes called the Speaker General of his own community, and he is so angry about these obstructions and delays, and in very tough winters, not enough food, not the food that was promised, all these sort of connivances and subterfuges to prevent them getting their land. He runs a kind of very articulate, ferocious petitioning, bombards the governor of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, and never gets a satisfactory answer. So he makes it all the way back to London, where he eventually does get a satisfactory answer. Well, that is truly a turning point in the life of people who had been slaves. I mean, I think every high school social studies textbook, although I basically my role in life is to A, abolish the phrase social studies and replace it by history, geography, and B, sort of, I don't know, threaten McGraw-Hill with, I don't know, sarcasm.
Let's try it another way.
See if it works.
Well, I do want to not let the notion of freedom go.
Mm.
Freedom is not just another word for nothing left to lose. Let me say.
The only line of lovely Janice's that you.
Chris Christopherson wrote it.
Oh, it's Chris Christopherson.
She's saying it, isn't it? That's true.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
And it's such a vitally important subject.
Yeah, it is.
Why is it that you say that it's not one idea, it's all of these possibilities?
Well, I tell you about another little anecdote, that, and it still slightly irks me occasionally. Despite having lived in the States and loving it for, you know, 25 plus years, there are moments when the kind of inner limey in me really sort of comes roaring out. And it was when I heard that, you know, that the Freedom Tower built on Ground Zero was going to have to be 1,776 feet tall. And now it's absurd because, you know, the building has changed so much and you have to have this basically kind of chopstick at the top in order to get, which has nothing on it, maybe a radio mast, but less significant than the Empire State Building, to get to that magic 1776. And I thought, well, what's the message of that? It is that freedom arrives in the world when the Brits go. Well, no. You know, I mean, it sort of does, but I thought we have many avenues to freedom. And if you say, well, who was embodying freedom at that particular moment in 76, well, if you ask the black community, the king was, not George Washington. If you ask a Massachusetts farmer, he'd be quite right in saying, of course, the Patriot side was. So, we were saying what they then deliver into after the revolution into the modern world are two different possibilities in Britain. There's a lot of hypocrisy on both sides, I have to say. Benjamin Franklin had a point when he said, well, it's all very well for you Brits to be so damn sanctimonious. How many blacks do you have living in Britain? And the answer was probably no more than 12,000. They thought 14. We have this enormous establishment, you know. In that for other of my heroes in the book, like Granville Sharp, was an explanation but not an excuse. He simply wanted abolitionists like Benjamin Franklin to live up to their principles and to be completely uncompromising about it. But the issue as we go into the 19th century is, in America, we have, on the one hand, as the early you know, black orators like Frederick Douglass were only too well aware when he said, what is your 4th of July to me? On the one hand, we had the most spectacular arrival of a genuine mass suffrage democracy in a way which absolutely put the kind of worm-eaten, rather aristocratic constitution of the British to shame. So there it all is for, you know, mass suffrage. But you have, as Gary Wills' excellent book, The Negro President, pointed out, you have a federal constitution based on the notion that, you know, a black man was two-thirds of a person. So you kind of fiddle the demographics in order to secure the system by which there could be a southern veto on the slave issue. So you have at the same time an immensely, genuinely noble philosophical principle horribly violated in social practice.
This is the Paula Gordon Show. I'm going to take a break so that Bill Russell can return in a moment with Simon Sharma. Be with us when we come back.